Welcome to the Horsewise podcast with Lynn Reardon, where we share stories of horses and people and what they teach each other. On today's episode, I have Alicia Landman and Brooke Tatro discussing the topic of misconceptions in horsemanship. I hope you enjoy the show and have a wonderful day. Hi, I'm Lynn Reardon, the host of the podcast and head coach at Horsewise. Today, I have back Alicia Landman and Brooke Tatro, two of my favorite horsemanship professionals. And the topic that Alicia brought up today was the idea of common misconceptions in horsemanship. And this turned into a pretty far-ranging conversation that went from, can competition horses also be gentle and laid back when they're not actually competing, to the idea of dream horses, also to the idea of how so many times horse professionals feel like they can do it all without rest. It was just a really fun conversation that covered a whole lot of ground. And I found it particularly philosophical. Afterwards, I really reviewed my notes and it kind of was thought-provoking to me. I always enjoy talking with Alicia and Brooke, and I really enjoy how much I learn every time we get together and talk. Enjoy the conversation. So, hey, Brooke and Alicia, it's great to have you again. I really appreciate you guys, as always, taking the time to talk to me on my podcast. So, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Always.
Yeah.
So, Alicia had a great topic on basically the topic was misconceptions. And I had immediately like five ideas pop into my mind about what that might be or what could be considered misconceptions. And I thought I would shut up about that so that Alicia could tell us what she had in mind when she came up with that topic. So what are your thoughts, Alicia, on misconceptions?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts about it, but and I know Brooke does too, and you do as well. And I'm sure we'll just, as usual, we'll just start talking about these things and it will just morph into a bunch of different fun conversations. But, over the weekend I was teaching with Melanie. We were in Chicago and I'm always just so blown away by the, athleticism of these jumpers and, how well they know their job and how great they do their job. But then when we go to like incorporate some of the basic groundwork in that would maybe get them lighter to the leg, and not have spur rubs and, just a lot of the things that start to happen. And I don't think it's because the rider means to do that, but we'll get stuck in that rut of just keeping our leg on all the time, and so it was really kind of a cool thing to experiment with these riders and their horses of how to get them lighter off the leg. And I think there's some misconceptions sometimes that a really high powered, great athletic jumper that's succeeding in the show ring, even though they're maybe winning and doing really well, sometimes it'll be revealed as to how we could get that horse lighter and understanding its job better. So even though they're winning and they're really succeeding, doesn't always mean that they're going to be maybe operating to their best of their abilities. And so a horse can be winning, but it doesn't always mean that, they're super gentle or they're super, they're really understanding their job. They're maybe just doing their job because they're just a good soldier and they have a rider that knows that particular job really well, but maybe doesn't know how to get them a little bit softer or a little more responsive so that we're not having to nag them the whole time. So that was one thought I had, and there's probably more, but.
What are your thoughts on that, Brooke? What do you think about what Alicia just says?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And we had talked about this earlier, there's, because it's some of these misconceptions, I feel like we've seen the same ones for so long or heard the same ones for, I just feel like my whole life,
Yeah.
And it's good that people like Alicia and Melanie and, are out there, breaking a lot of the misconceptions, right? Because you're kind of in the right in the thick of it with her, you know, with these other disciplines and stuff. And yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. And they, you can be winning and be succeeding and still not, still have room to grow. You can always get better and just have to be open-minded and, you know, see what information is out there.
I find it interesting that this idea that, oh, I don't know if this is quite what you've experienced, Alicia, but sometimes I get the sense, or I'll hear from riders who have successful jumpers, that they're almost afraid to mess with anything. Like, oh, yeah, this is how he goes. So if he's softer, then we're going to stop winning. And I find that really an interesting, well, misconception, right? The topic of the podcast, because it means they would only do their job better and also potentially for a lot longer. There's no reason why the longevity of that show career couldn't be even extended with a horse that's happier and more balanced, more versatile, maybe. Or it could be a horse that, as it does get older, that it could go into another career, whether it's a lower key version of its current competition career or into the next iteration. And the longevity of these athletes is something that I think sometimes gets overlooked, because it's just assumed, well, they're going to stop at this point no matter what, rather than, well, if we changed a couple things here and there, maybe you would have longer, higher performance with lower stress. And that could be an athlete that's in the ring for longer, and you're enjoying it and he's enjoying it. And, you know, why not go for that? But it's this idea that, oh, if I, it's almost like a house of cards, you know, so if you move this and the horse gets quieter or gentler on the ground, they're going to lose their fire or they're going to lose their ability. And it's just like, so I don't know what you would say.
That's definitely something that comes up a lot. You know, it's like, oh, well, you know, if it's going to be a Grand Prix level, whatever, that, you know, it needs to really be, you know, it's got to have its wild side or whatever. And it's just like, no, I mean, you can get a horse to really power up when you need to, and you can get it to power down too, but you definitely have to practice both, you know? And that misconception is definitely out there, you know, like, oh, the barrel horse, you know, like the barrel horse can actually be relaxed and have manners. And yes, it has to come really up with life, but it can also learn how to come back down. It's just totally what we put into practice when we're teaching them, you know, the basics, so that eventually you can really ask them for a ton of life, and, you know, they're not doing it just out of sheer, you know, fear. They're doing it because they understand what their job is. So, yeah.
I feel like better performance.
Yeah, it's like they think that.
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I was just gonna say, it's like they think that, you know, quiet equals dull, you know, or,
right.
You know, if a horse is quiet and relaxed, that they must be dull, that there's not, you know, no energy there, but it can be totally the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the one I've probably heard the most, like, over the years from people, is I still hear it. I think I heard it like the week before last, you know, so on my list. My list of misconceptions.
I think it's interesting how very skilled riders, again, I could never compete at the Grand Prix level. I mean, that's just not on the table for me. So these are skilled athletes, the riders, human athletes. But yet there's almost this superstition sometimes that can come into it, as if there's no confidence in the horse being able to be flexible, to change, or that the way that we've always done it is sort of the only way. And I find it interesting that there's less confidence about that. Whereas I tend to look at these athletes who are jumping at that level, the human athletes, and I'm like, that's so impressive. You're so incredibly adaptive. you know, and yet this one thing is like a hard stop for you. And so it's just, and we all have our things, right? Like we all have our things that we have blind spots on or whatever, but it doesn't take that much to demonstrate the change. I think that's so great, something great that you and Melanie are offering, Alicia, to that particular discipline.
Sure. And it's been very rewarding to see how many people, you know, they give it a try and they start to feel the difference in the horses and how quick a horse can change when you give them the right information. And, you know, like lowering their heads. I always find that so interesting, like just touching a horse and you touch them on the pole and you touch them on their nose and just ask them to lower their head. And it's like, they're so used to like leaning up against something that it takes them a while to figure out that they could actually yield to that. And in how just those little things added to what they're already doing are just going to make them an even better and more successful athlete. But, you know, we put all this money into massages and chiropractic and all that stuff. And just what an impact the human touch has on just thinking about that and committing to it and teaching a horse how to yield. And just how it isn't just about the pole, you know, I mean, it's about every time you touch them and ask them to do something, you know, are they yielding to it or are they pushing into it? And so many of those riders that Melanie and I see, they have such a high level of talent, but they haven't been exposed to it. And so, I think that, you know, it's a rewarding thing to be able to see them implement it and then leave them for a year, come back. And some of them are very honest. Like, I haven't practiced any of what you taught me because I'm a little bit still unsure what to do, but I'll touch those horses and they remember everything that we did a year ago, which is so awesome.
That's amazing.
A little goes a long way. They'll get to practicing it more, I think, in the future once they feel more comfortable. But it is, I think, very intimidating for a person to be kind of, they're on an island, you know, like they're maybe the only person at their barn that's trying it. And so a little intimidating.
It's hard.
Yeah, good for them, you know, because I think that like when you're really into that, you know, and you're at those big show barns and, you know, you're competing and doing all these things and the horses look good and you're winning ribbons and doing the thing. But I don't even think that they, like, we see those things, or I feel like a lot of us see those things, those little things like that. And you think about the horse's happiness, you know, like, okay, they're doing fine, but you know, they can't be that happy feeling like that all the time. Right. But I don't, in my experience at those barns, like those people didn't even see it as that, you know, it's a different perspective. And so it's like, it's unintentional, you know, but like, they just don't recognize. I don't think like that doesn't look happy, you know, to me or whatever. And so just to get a chance to see it, you know, for them to go somewhere and see it and see the difference and how, if you really think about it, like you were saying, Lynn, over a long period of time, not only physically could they be more successful and last longer and be healthier, but mentally too, you know? And, but I think if you don't have somebody around to expose you to it, like you don't even know that it's out there or what it looks like or, you know, how important it is, things like that. So it's great that like Melanie does that, you know, involves you and Noah and whoever's, you know, Buck in the past and, you know, great horsemen, just to get it out there to some other successful big riders too. And everybody, and, you know, just spreading the word.
Something that I've really enjoyed about these clinics too, is that like occasionally, cause we're in different parts of the country where, you know, there's some more, you know, I wouldn't necessarily call them, you know, Western riders per se, but students that study a little bit more intently the horsemanship side of things, and they want to come and participate in one of these with, you know, pole work and jumping or whatever. And I think like a misconception from the horsemanship side of things is thinking that we're not ready to go and do a course of poles or a small course of cross rails or something. So we hold ourselves back and we don't let our horse go learn a job and let the job of the poles or the jumps be what teach the flying change or be what helps teach the horse balance on their own. So we're trying to set up the balance for the horse all the time, you know, and perfect all of our horsemanship maneuvers. But then there comes a point where you've got to test it and you have to put yourself into a position of like, it's not going to be perfect, but I need to go try to do this job and see where my horsemanship skills are actually effective or I'm late and non-effective. And so that's been another fun thing to be like, okay, let's put this together and let's do a job. Even if the horse is not a jumper or a hunter, but they can look where they're going and they can, you know, practice turning and getting accurate and turning back quick to another pole or a jump or something like that. And it just puts a little more practical, you know, implementation of all of the aids that we work on getting so subtle. So that was something that was in my brain over the weekend.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. And I think too that I'm certainly guilty of like trying to get everything right, you know, for the horse or whatever, because that's kind of the world I live in, you know. Yes. I'm not a competitor or whatever, but the horses really need to learn on their own that they can carry themselves. And we can't really do that for them all the time. Like we can support, like we don't want to get in their way, but sometimes I feel like the horses don't get an opportunity to exercise volition, if for lack of a better word, that I can set it up for you, horse, so that you can explore this turn that's coming up with these poles, but I'm not going to exert every force at my means to keep you from making a mistake. If you need to make that, as long as it's not disastrous, right, so that you can learn that this is, you're carrying me, I'm not carrying you. I'm here to support you, but not to manhandle you or carry you. And, you know, there is a cliche, but I mean, it can be true sometimes. Like I've seen it maybe a little more with dressage horses where they can be so used to being held up depending on, you know, what kind of training they have been exposed to and what kind of a conformation they have. And then when you soften the rein, they almost fall over. Like they're just so, and I think this idea of having the job where the horse is looking at the poles, and it doesn't have to be like, you know, giant jumps. It could be little cross rails or things where you're going to have to pick your feet up or you're going to whack yourself a little bit. I don't want you to, but it's going to be, you're going to have to do that. And not saying, oh, no matter what, don't do that. It's like, well, it's not going to hurt you, but it might remind you of where your feet are. I can't tell you where your feet are all the time. You need to. So that's something that's kind of interesting. And I think there can be a misconception that it's somehow wrong to allow a horse to figure that out, because sometimes they will make mistakes or it won't look pretty, like you're saying, Alicia, like it won't look, the rider won't look like they're on the most perfect horse at that moment. And then the horse might look a little awkward. You know, if you work, you guys both work with young horses a lot, you know that the most well-bred, you know, nice moving young horse sometimes just looks like a giraffe on cocaine because they've got their legs everywhere. And if, you know, you have to kind of, hey, you guys have to learn. So that's an interesting, to me, that can blend into another misconception, which is that, you know, we have to always make it perfect for them or they aren't allowed to make mistakes ever. And it's not mistakes, obviously, that aren't fatal. We're not trying to go for those. And
right,
I just like, it's like with a little, I don't have kids, so I really can't pontificate about raising children, especially to you, Alicia, who is a mom. But I know that most of the good parents I know say, I have to let my child make some mistakes, you know, particularly as they get more into that middle school, high school era. Like I can't, you know, they need to learn that on their own. And there's something with that, with the horses too, in their own bodies, that depending on the horse and the job, it's important to allow them to, and then they gain the confidence. They don't feel like, oh, you know, Lynn's just manhandling me around here. I don't really understand this job. They're taking part in it. They're learning how to carry them and then feel proud of themselves afterwards.
Exactly. So. And giving horses and humans time to give them something to work on that is attainable, but letting them know that there has to be like a little, there's got to be a sense of like letting the horse understand what you're asking for. And if they make that mistake or they get crooked or whatever, you know, our job is to put them back into the area where they can be successful, but giving them just enough freedom so that we aren't just holding them all together, you know, constantly. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's definitely, a big part, I think, of a horse understanding, collection eventually is that, they have to be able to do some challenging jobs at, a level that isn't too far beyond where they're at. But you know, if we just kind of stay in our little safety zone too much, then we never really grow, you know, and we don't expand. And I mean, I've been guilty of that. I know for, you know, I think we're always working on that to get better and better at, not dulling the horse down to our level, you know, pushing slightly outside of the comfort zone without blowing it completely.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Brooke? What are some of the misconceptions on your list?
Well, I mean, I have a few of them on here. well, one that Alicia and I talked about when she was here a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about this subject of misconceptions, and you were saying, you know, that there's like a, you know, this picture of how you think your horse should look, you know, in your head that you've learned or seen over the years. And, you know, but for each individual horse, it's always going to look a little different, you know? So depending on how the horse is built and how they go or where they're at in their training, what level they're at, how much, you know, together they are, you know, it's always going to look a little different. So one horse, you know, may need to carry itself below the withers or level with the withers, and another horse might need to be, you might be asking them a lot to come above, you know, above the withers with their pole, and just, you know, just kind of those misconceptions about, you know, this is what a collected horse should look like, or this is what, you know, this level horse should look like, or a bridle horse or your snaffle horse. And really it's an ever-changing kind of picture, and it's not going to be the same for every horse and every rider. And yeah, so that, I thought that was, you know, an interesting one, because it can be hard, you know, because you see, especially in, you know, in dressage or anything that there's competition, people are emulating what's winning. You know, you see how these horses are going and you think that's how your horse should go. And, but that's just not always the case. You know, it's on such a individual basis.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think,
feel like I'm rambling. I don't know if it's
Western,
coherent Western, or not.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. The Western pleasure world, I think, is one that's, you know, notably one that is, just kind of, they're a little bit stuck and, you know, all the horses look the same. They're all kind of four beating around, you know? But it was interesting because I have this friend that knows a judge at a very high level, and the judge said, I pray every show that somebody will bring one that actually is moving in a three beat rhythm. But if all you're judging is what's in the pen and every single one of them is four beating, then I have to place what's in front of me, you know? And it's like, oh man, don't you just wish that they could just say, you're all getting nothing.
Yeah. Go zero. Away and
come back, you know?
But, no score for you.
Fix that awful thing and come back.
You all get last place. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Everybody's
F
getting an
everybody.
F.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting too that people don't take into account individual confirmation, individual, again, if you are, and I appreciate the show world. I mean, I don't think we would have as many horses in this country without the show world. You know, I think it's great. The competition is really cool. I love the variety. I think that's really fun. But if you have a horse that's a reining horse and you want that horse to do upper level classical dressage, you know, you're going to need to take some time to help that horse understand those movements and also recognize that your horse was bred and designed specifically for another sport with very different movement and not blame the horse or yourself, right? And that's an extreme example. I don't think necessarily people would do that, but sometimes you can get a very nice young warm blood who really needs to jump and doesn't need to do dressage or vice versa, even though they have beautiful movement and all the things. And I think it's important to give yourself permission as the rider to make that assessment and not feel like you're doing something wrong if your horse needs it to be a little different or if you need it to be a little different, you know. Not everybody wants to progress at the same level. Sometimes it is you don't want to keep a horse back, but sometimes some horses occasionally need to be slowed down just a little bit, and that can be a nice suit for a rider, a nice matchup for a rider that likes to build that foundation, and that might be the thing that really makes the difference for that horse that's a little hot and disorganized. You know, it's a nice blend. So I remember you talking, Brooke, about Alo, how he was such a big game changer for you because you would be sitting there thinking, oh, shouldn't we be further along? But he was a very specific kind, he is a very specific kind of horse. And if you had been hell-bent on this is where we should be at this stage, it wouldn't have turned out the way it has, you know, and he was worth it, you know, but he was very specific. He was built to do it all. It's nothing about confirmation. It was more about high degree of sensitivity. And he's lucky to have found you, that's for sure, Brooke.
Well, he was very specific today and yesterday on our rides out.
Oh,
Because
no. Oh,
we
no,
haven't been
I brought
outside much in a while.
a
Yeah,
sore
no,
point.
it
That's
was
funny.
fine. It was fine. He was fine. He
But you
was
know which
just
horse I would
very
want
happy to be out and
to,
about in
which
the
horse I
40
would
mile an
want to
hour
be
wind, you
on
know.
if the world was kind of coming to an end and I needed to stay safe. I think Ayla would be the top on my list to want to ride because
Yeah.
he's gonna see all the zombies before anyone else, the way you described him, Brooke. And he's gonna be like, we need to avoid this, we need to do this. Yeah.
That's funny. But going back to what you were saying about like the reining horse versus the dressage horse, there's a really cool example of that is a rider that she's from Northern Michigan. Rachel Ori is her
Oh,
name.
cool.
And she shows a horse named Jagalicious, and she rode it at a very high level in reining. It was extremely successful. And then she decided to take that same horse and do Western dressage with it and killed it and won a bunch of, you know, world championship stuff on it. But then also decided, well, now that I've kind of checked that box, I'm going to go do real dressage with it. And so she took it, you know, I think to fourth level or something like that.
Cool.
And, you know, just the ability to go from reining to Western dressage to the actual dressage and how horses are so willing to do whatever it is that, you know, they want to try to get with us. And if it's a person who really cares about getting with them and studying it, that, you know, you can do a lot of that and cross training and the horse can learn the job and it's awesome.
Yeah. For you, Brooke, would you say that when you had brought up the misconception of it doesn't have to look a certain way at a certain time and so forth, did you have in mind maybe sometimes people being a little hard on themselves or being a little bit hot, too high expectations for the horse or a little both? You seem like you had something
Probably,
specific in your mind. Yeah.
I mean, probably a little of both. And I mean, I've been stuck in those things too, you know, where you see something maybe many, many, many times and you're just like, yeah, you know, it could be totally come from a good place, right? Like I want my horse to look like that, you know, or whatever. So yeah, I mean, I think it can be both. It can be you went too quick with the horse, or it can just be like, I want my horse to look like this, but that's not what this horse is going to look like. You know what I mean? Like everybody's going to go in their own sort of way, but that does have a lot to do, I think, with who their rider is as well. You know, when you look at really good riders like Buck and Ray, and even like Isaac and Noah, like you could tell like all the horses that they ride kind of look the same, even though they're not, you know what I mean? Like there's that part of it too. And it's like their own personal stamp, you know, it's pretty cool.
It's very artistic in a way.
Yeah, I think it's a little, it's a little of both.
Yeah. And that they'll go for a certain type of horse or certain look of horse that they know will go. I mean, because like, can you ever imagine? I couldn't really ever imagine Buck riding more of like, you know, the snow shovely type, like downhill, real super stocky. You know, he's always on like the longer legged, lean, tall, almost. Mm-hmm. You know, throw like appendix.
Out, yeah,
quarter horse. So it's like just a different look, a different style. But I always find that really interesting.
yeah. But that's exactly right. You know, like if you're riding that kind of quarter horse, like Banner or something, you know, like that short, wide. Right now, pretty downhill, probably, you know, but he's not going to look like, you know, Rebel or, you know, like those horses of Bucks, even if I ride him to the best of his and my ability. That's just not how he's ever going to look, right? Like, no matter what. But I think that's kind of where people get, you know, like they think, okay, if I can't get this horse to look like that horse, then maybe I'm not doing a good enough job or something, you know, but it's just like, that horse isn't going to look like this other one, I guess.
And being able to get them soft, right? And get them balanced and get them educated, they'll have their own style and their own way of going, you know? And I think appreciating every horse for, you know, who they are and knowing what their physical abilities are or maybe aren't, you know, and even horses that have, you know, past injuries or a crooked leg or, you know, all these other things, like they can still greatly benefit from the work of being soft, supple, and balanced. But that, you know, we don't need to just like crank a horse up just to make it look like it's, you know, in collection or whatever, you know, it's like that has to come through such a gradual process and of strengthening them and riding them in a correct way. And, each horse can find a way of going that's suited to make them last longer.
Yeah. Kind of bringing out the best in that individual horse, for that horse. So in terms of, their personality, their temperament, their build, horses, at least in my experience, you know, I work with horses that are a little bit odd, let's say. I mean, they can be a little odd, but they still have very clear cut opinions about what they like and don't like for work. And I always find that really interesting and very important to pay attention to. And because a lot of the horses I work with, you could say, well, they're used up. And some of them are a little used up for certain kinds of activities, but they each have, this very individualistic quality that I find very appealing to explore. And even if this horse will primarily do groundwork and very light riding, what is the type of rider? What is the type of ride? How do they need to be prepared for that? And then when you're able to bring out the best in that horse based on that horse's what that horse individually brings to the table, I find that really rewarding, whether it's something that is performance-based or not. And of course with me, it's rarely performance-based, but that's why when we've done our internship program, we often will get young equestrians who are competing, and some of them are competing at quite a high level. And what they like about our program is that the horses aren't like that. So it's almost like they feel like they're allowed to pay attention to things with our horses that they wouldn't so much with their own, because they're in the competition mode, yet they love their horses. It's nothing negative. It's just almost, again, going back to, it's almost like a superstitious thing. Like, I don't want to mess up, you know, my horse's ability to win at this particular sport, but I like working with the lope horses or with the horsewise horses because they're a little odd, and they can feel that sense of reward without feeling like they're trading off something. I don't know if I'm putting that quite into words, but it's been interesting to see very talented young riders respond to these horses that will never be high performance, but teaching them something on the ground or watching them think through a problem. And then when they go back to their own horses in the competition ring, it does kind of carry in an interesting way. But if I tried to do it with very expensive high level horses, it's almost like that would create almost a weird blind spot for them. I don't know. It's kind of interesting perspective.
Well, it's really nice that, that those horses, like you said, they might not be able to go and do jobs like that, but that have a real purpose in the world for helping riders that already have horses, and that they can take what they feel from those and go, oh, why wouldn't I ask my horse to do this same exact thing, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe my horse could learn that even.
And those earplugs and those head bonnet things, that always is one of those, you know, where people will ask, like, should I, you know, do you want the earplugs and the thing? And I was like, this is the time to, like, strip them of all of the extra stuff, you know, and just, like, strip it down to just the basics. Like, what happens if you lose your earplug? You know, what happens if your bridle falls off? Like, and everybody's eyes usually are like,
oh my God, I'll die.
My bridle fell off. I would die, you know? And I'm like, well, that's the problem. Like,
Let's discuss that. And sometimes there's this concept too about, I feel like I keep talking and Brooke needs to talk more than me. It's almost as if, well, I bring my horse to the mounting block and they're really nervous about the mounting block, and I just need them to stand still anyway, come and hold my horse so that I can get started with the lesson. And it's like, well, the horse is telling you that the mounting block is where I have a horse that we're working with now through the program. She's a brood mare, been a brood mare for many years, I guess. And she was a racehorse before then. And she just has a heck of a time going up to the main riding arena. Last 2 weeks ago, she thought she was going to be bred, because this is the time of year she's bred. So she's like looking for the stallion. We're like, there's no date up here. We're just taking you. And I mean, for her, for whatever combination, this is the hardest thing for her. And I could be like, well, I should be doing X, Y, and Z with her now. I should be doing this. I should be doing that. And I'm like, look, she's stubbing her toe literally on, like, walking into the arena. Let's work on that. Like, that's, we could pretend like that's not there and throw a bridle on her and ride her ugly around the arena, or we could just address it. Like, here it is. It's coming up early. And that's what's so straightforward about these horses for me. It's like, well, there it is. He's telling you that, you know, the trailer's a no. Let's work on what goes before the trailer, leading or, you know, moving the feet. And that's a little bit different perspective, because I think people are like, well, I need to really focus on, I'm in the clinic with Melanie and Alicia, or I'm with Brooke at this big clinic, and I need to get on my horse and so we can work on the stuff, and he won't let me mount him, but dang it, I'm just going to have someone hold him so I can get on and get started. And it can be a hard cultural shift or whatever to go, hey, let's just work on that. That's where it's showing up. It's actually easier to address it before you get on for most horses. Why not do it easier?
It's hard to convince people sometimes to slow down and work on those things that, you know, are for the rest of their life. And
Yeah. And if you grew up riding English, you know, that's never like a part of your lesson. That would be an unconventional writing lesson. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, that's how it was for me all my life. Like, you know, that's in the horsemanship world, that's not unconventional or uncommon, right? We work on those types of things all the time, but I don't even think like, yeah, I don't, most people don't even think, like you said, I hurry up so and get me on so I can get to my lesson instead of thinking, oh, well, this could be, you know,
the lesson.
Maybe this could be my lesson today since I'm having such a hard time. But yeah,
so hard for people to slow down sometimes and just work on, you know, what's right there in front of you so that it, the rest of your riding career, you can be smooth and quick and efficient, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've all been there, but we learn.
Yeah. What other misconceptions come to mind?
Well, I have a little list, but do we want to do the like gripey ones or the
or well, it's our podcast, ones, so know? we can do the gripey ones and if it's super harsh, I'll just edit it out so that nobody feels like they're shaming people. But I have a gripey one, so you guys go, and then if you feel uncomfortable, I'll step in and gripe it out for you.
Well, I talked to some of the girls at the barn about this a couple of weeks ago. You know, I was just like, hey, this is what we're thinking about talking about, you know, like what kind of misconceptions do you guys have? And our friend Jackie, who is a professional, you know, for years riding, you know, for years, and some of the girls that ride at the barn, I mean, everybody had a bunch of them, you know, and I was like, okay, I just don't want the podcast to turn into like us venting, you know, about people. But you know, you can't help but write some down and laugh about it. So, well, I always laugh at, and I've seen it a bunch of times too, about how, like, if you ride a certain, inside the natural horsemanship is where I feel like I see it. Like if you ride with somebody a lot, whoever it be, you know, I feel like you kind of pick up on not mm-hmm. only the things that they're teaching you in the ring, but the style and the tradition and kind of everything that goes with it. Right. I mean, there's gotta be a lot of that in Texas too, right? The guys down there and long traditions. You know, we're right. Yeah. Same with, you know, Montana and Wyoming and Nevada. And, but anyway, you know, for me, it's like a respectful thing, you know, and to be part of the tradition, but you always see all those people calling it like, oh, you're dressing like your guru and, you know, like, you just are wannabes and like, you're not a cowboy. Why are you wearing a cowboy hat? You know what I mean? Just those, those misconceptions of like, I mean, some people might be doing it for those reasons, but I feel like, well, we were talking about it when I was in Nashville last fall, Alicia, with Troy and our friend, Mary McCashin, and Troy said it pretty well. He's like, hey, if I'm, he's like, I want to look nice, even if I'm just riding to the mailbox and back. Like, I want to look nice on my horse, you know, I want my horse to look nice. Like, I'm not trying to impress anybody or, you know, I'm not doing it for whatever these reasons are. It's just like, you want to be a bit, you know, respectful of it, I guess. I don't know. I always think that one's funny. But then again, a long time ago at a buck clinic at Betty Staley's house, like back in the day, I was riding some warm blood, I'm sure. And I always had cowboy boots and my chaps on, but then I always had like a polo shirt and a baseball cap, you know, because right. I don't
why
know.
Why not cross dress? Yeah. Right.
How I did it. How I rolled. And after the clinic one night, we're all sitting around and Buck says, I need to talk to you about you're cross-dressing, you know? And I'm like, what? And he's like, you're cross-dressing. He's like, it's got to stop, you know? Like, you know, like do better, basically, is what he was saying.
Rise
was
up, like, rise up to God. The occasion. Okay. Yeah, rise up.
Yeah. I think I went out and bought a like palm leaf hat like that weekend. Like I'm not showing back up in a baseball hat. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm glad he said it. I'm glad he said it. Somebody needed to, so I'm glad he did. But anyway, I find that to be like one of the funny, you know, misconceptions that were, I don't know, that it's this guru thing and you have to, you know, dress a certain way or be a certain way. And it's not like that at all. And no, and I don't want people to like not want to come thinking that they're gonna, because I feel like when people do come and sometimes they feel out of place, right? Because they're not wearing all the garb, you know? Right. And I don't want people to feel like that. And I don't want people to feel like if you are wearing all the garb, that we're saying that about you or thinking that about you, you know, when you're at a clinic, or at a horse show or something like that, because, you know, if you're there and you're trying, you know, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
What you look like or
and
what you're wearing.
There's so much and function to the gear too, that I think like what we've all recognized over the years, you know, is just how much more comfortable and, you know, like McCarty Rain bridle setups and just, you know, having saddle strings to be able to like tie your stuff on if you're going out. And there's just like, there's so much like practicality to everything that it becomes part of, like you use it because you're like, wow, that actually has a really good useful purpose for it. And it helps me get my job done better, you know, but it's also interesting how like as time has gone on and you know, and I know Brooke, you deal with this too, where you have like so many different disciplines that you as a teacher don't even notice what people are wearing as long as it fits properly and it's working for the horse and it's functioning for the person. Like, I mean, yeah, I really like it when somebody can ride correctly in a snaffle bit, but if you came in with like, you know, some other type of bit, it's not that you're not included, you know, or you're not going to get some value out of the lesson, but that you don't have to completely change everything that you're doing to learn some of this horsemanship and some of this style and to be able to integrate it into what you're already doing. You just start to understand that, you know, yeah, the gear is important, but, also, if you're coming from a totally different discipline, it's still going to work. We're still going to make that work, you know, and you're going to get some benefit to it. And eventually you might kind of change a little bit what you're doing because you realize it suits your horse better. But, you know, what somebody comes in and looks like initially is not, I'm with you, Brooke. Like, I don't ever want somebody to feel like they're not welcomed or allowed to like ride in their sweatshirt. Now, if you show up in a tube top, I'm probably going to have some words with you, but.
Yeah, you gotta be appropriate. Yeah. And on the same hand though, you know, you don't want people to feel bad about like, hey, if this is what you're into and this is what you're spending your hard earned money on is your good gear. And, you know, I mean, I would spend every dime I had on leather and rawhide and silver before I go, you know, I have like 3 pairs of shoes. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I have one, this is true. And I might cut it out of the podcast because it's so sad. I have 1 pair of earrings and 1 necklace. And my husband's always like, do you want more jewelry? And I'm like, I'm just going to lose it. And it's not that I have the fanciest gear, because I certainly don't, but I am much more likely to get, like, I have more than 3 pairs of shoes, but they're all boots that I use, like, so I totally, no judgment on that at all, like, you know, not for me. No.
Right, yeah, that's what I mean, you know, so when I hear people, it irks me a little bit when I read it or hear it, you know, when people are like, oh, you're dressing like your guru, blah, 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 you know, and it's like, okay, well, you know, took me like 20 years to buy all this stuff, you know? So calm down. I've been working at it for a minute and it doesn't, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm finally to that point, you know, where, or, you know, you have a nice bridal horse and you want to ride in your nice bridle or your nice hat or your button up shirt or whatever, then that's fine too, you know? Absolutely. And it doesn't mean that you're trying to be somebody, you know?
No, and you guys, I mean, I'm just gonna, I do this occasionally at the beginning of the podcast when I've interviewed both of you together, I'll sometimes put this in the intro or the extra where I remind my listeners, and this is not to in any way deprecate myself, but I'll always say to my listeners, so Brooke and Alicia are really amazing and good. And I'm kind of like this nerdy teenager that's following them, even though that's not really the way the numbers go. But, and so I'm very aware of that. So I feel really fortunate to just be hanging out. I'm like your kid sister, even though I'm like, you know, like I said, numerically, it's the other way around. But for me, I feel like when people, I feel like people like you two, you both started very differently. You were both professionals from the start. You both were, you know, competing or working with competition horses, and you came from very different backgrounds than where, what you happen to wear now. But you came through a process of study, lifelong study, decades of study, and this is where it has led you. And so that gear suits you in every respect. And if you're working with young horses, if you're developing high-level horses, it is important to have gear that works for you and the horse. So I am more of the crazy cross-dresser. So I'm going to tell you guys a really funny story. Please don't judge me. But so I was such a casual rider. You know, I didn't learn to ride till I was an adult. And I did ride polo horses, terrible polo player, but I loved to exercise because it was a way to ride cheaply, right? And so what everybody did in the polo world is you wear jeans and you either wear tall boots or you wear half chaps and paddock boots. So that's what I did. And I'd have the polo helmet, which looks like a motorcycle helmet, is the nerdiest thing ever. And that's what I rode in all the time. And then as I became a little more exposed to this kind of horsemanship and I started working, you know, with the charity horses, someone told me about Tom Curtin and I was going to go ride with Tom Curtin. And I realized that everybody, the first day of class was in like, you know, jeans, but tucked in Western shirts and no half chaps or, and I'm like, oh, so I went and all I had was this giant, like, fishing shirt. Like it was like a Columbia shirt, but it was too big for me. And it was beige, it was a terrible color for me. And I put that on, I tried to tuck it in. I mean, it's just like coming out everywhere. And I'm like trying to tuck it in. And I had these Gap jeans that were a little too short. And so like the tops of my pack, I'm like, I'm going to try and look Western. And Tom was just like, oh my God. And I still wear jeans and half chaps because it's really comfortable. And I don't track dirt into the house as much. But in the winter, I wear my chaps. So that's the compromise I've worked out. But I have never felt unwelcome. And I've really come to appreciate the gear. And I mean, the Mercate alone is such an incredible tool, not only because you have the extra rein, but because the feel of those reins is just so different. And I don't think people realize that until you ride that way. So hopefully I'm an ambassador to bring the fashion challenged people to kind of look at what is really working equipment wise. And I've been fortunate enough to ride with many different people who were all, the first clinic I ever rode in was Ray Hunt. So that's pretty cool, right? That's the way to start, right? And you know, for sure. So I feel like people who maybe come in with that brace about, hey, it is kind of like a brace, you're dressing like your guru or whatever, there can be just maybe a little bit of under the surface and anxiety about learning something new or maybe a fear of changing. Anybody who is a teacher, a clinician who makes their students feel like they should dress like them is somebody who doesn't have a lot to offer. So though, and I've never felt that from the good people, you know, I've never felt like, well, I'm really being judged by Buck or I'm really, you know, I never felt that way at all. And I've also ridden with some,
I was being judged.
Well, you were being judged because you probably looked awful. No, just kidding.
I'm just kidding. I'm just joking.
And your gear for the kind of riding you were doing and as advanced as you were was super inappropriate, probably. So just to really like drive it home, Brooke. Were you wearing a purple? Was it a purple cap? Was it like a really outrageous color?
No, I'm sure that I have pictures somewhere, but who knows? Who knows? The funny part is that I think the only palm leaf hat I could find was like a 6-inch or 8-inch. It looked like a sombrero on me.
Oh, wow.
Like it was. So I don't know if it was better or worse.
That reminds me. I have one hat. I don't do cowboy hats, but I do. So I have this, the sunbonnet.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
This is.
Those are great hats. That's a great hat.
It's a great hat, and it's 11 years old. Yeah. I got it at a clinic, you know, and Isaac shaped it for my head back in the day when he was 12 or whatever. So, I mean, he's probably older than that. But, you know, it's like that's how great that gear is. I mean, that hat was not terribly expensive, and there it is. I still have it 11 years later.
Isn't that great? Oh, my God. I know.
It's awesome.
I wish, like, I could tell my younger self, you know, when I was like 6 and I had the pony and I showed up to the little local Mother's Day horse show and I had tied a bed sheet around her. And I like tried to wrap her legs and the pillows, like the wraps were all on backwards and wrong. And in the white bed sheet and a red halter and I had like a purple shirt. I mean, I looked like the biggest idiot on earth, right? But like, to be in a place where you don't have the money, you know, to buy good gear and you don't have, and I so remember that feeling, you know, and I know there's a lot of people out there that are just scraping by to keep their horse. And so they're really proud of that bed sheet and that red halter and that crappy purple shirt, you know, and the blue cowboy hat that, I mean, everything was not working for me. I was like, Mother, I know we didn't have a lot of money, but we probably could have put this together so I didn't look like a clown, you know, but.
Could have at least matched or something.
Yeah, I was just thinking,
you know?
That, like the colors maybe could have not clashed.
I'm
going
to try to find that picture and send it to you guys because it's the funniest thing you've ever seen. But, you know, there's so much pride that goes into, you know, owning all this gear that is handmade and by people who have studied and worked so hard to develop great stuff, you know? And so, I'm with you, Brooke. Like when I hear people say like, you know, oh, you're dressing like so-and-so or you're trying to mimic. And it's like, you know what? No, I worked my ass off to get this stuff and I'm darn proud of it, you know?
Right.
And,
exactly.
And I'm never going to stop wanting more of it because it's so beautiful and it's just makes riding that much more special.
Yeah. And it is a way to honor the horse and the
feels
tradition.
Yeah, exactly. It just feels like, yes, honoring the tradition. Exactly. Yep. And supporting those artists, really, you know, the rawhide braiders and the silversmiths and saddle makers and those guys that have been doing it forever and are just amazing at it, you know, and it's like, I know I do tell people sometimes, like, you know, if they're looking to buy a Bozell or something, I really will tell them, like, listen, you can buy like an okay one at the store for $350 or for $500, which isn't that much more money. You can get a handmade one from like Vince Don, you know, and it'll be beautiful and live forever and hold its value and just be a work of art that you can live your life kind of like, you know, clothes, right? You're living your life in it or your horse is living its life in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's so if you can spend the money or you save up for it, you know, or whatever you got to do, it's worth it to get, you know, to spend a little bit more and have that, for me it is, have that.
And I'd rather ride
piece of it.
I'd rather ride in a nice snaffle and not subject my horse to wearing a really crappy, you know, piece of rawhide that's got wire up and through it instead of like one that's handmade with quality that's balanced right, you know. There's no rush to get to that gear if it's not the type of gear that's actually going to feel good to the horse. So
agreed. Agreed. Yeah.
Right.
Do you have
Yeah.
any other gripey, gripey misconceptions?
Oh yeah.
We have any more? We've got. It's only an hour podcast.
I know. I know. We have, I know. We might have to do a two-parter. I'm gonna do real quick.
Yep.
A speed dial
yeah.
one.
Sure.
It's just a pet peeve, and when people say they're looking for their dream horse, and they want to get a horse that will be a step-up horse, but also will fulfill everything that they've ever wanted to accomplish, I just feel like that's so much pressure to put on a horse. Like, I don't want to be anybody's dream wife. Like, God, no. Like, geez, I can barely, you know. So, and it's not to be mean about, I mean, I think it's really cool when you can, you know, acquire the financial stability to buy a really nice horse. I'm not saying that you have to buy a cheap horse or anything, but there's something about the term dream horse that always just makes me feel like, oh, that's a lot of pressure. You know, are you the dream owner? Are you the dream rider for that horse? And so that's just it's a language thing, I think, maybe more than a gripe. And I would just say, hey, maybe, you know, just a different term. It just puts a lot of pressure on that horse right from the start.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, if we could do a whole podcast on people buying and selling horses. Do you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. clients buying horses without having somebody without, you know, an inexperienced person buying horses without, you know, somebody helping them. And I mean, I think we could do like a whole gripey podcast on that whole thing, right? It's like probably one of the hardest parts of doing this for a living, right? Is sometimes dealing with like either having to sell some horses that are not that easy, or, you know, or people buy horses that just aren't right for them because they actually think they're buying their dream horse. Cause right. I want something that's, you know, 16.2 hands and gray and, you know, has long eyelashes and whatever else. And I'm not saying you can't find the right horse for you that isn't absolutely beautiful, cause you can, but I'm just saying like, yeah, I think the whole dream horse thing does get in the way too, because you just have to find the right horse. And
yeah,
if it is cool. The right horse, it'll be the dream horse, you know, anyway, and it won't matter, you know, what color it is and all that stuff.
I love that. I love right horse. So. Yeah.
Yeah. And I really loved what you said about how, you know, somebody might say they want a dream horse, but are you the dream owner sort of thing? Like, we have to be realistic that a lot of our horses, they don't end up becoming the dream until many years down the road, you know? And so you might buy one that maybe doesn't check like all the boxes, but the more that you put that work in and you take the time to develop the relationship, it really can become something that is far better than you expected, you know?
Yeah.
And then sometimes it's the other way around. You buy the dream horse and then you're like, oh my gosh, this thing is, it's hurting itself every other day. Like, it's got all these allergies. It's got all these problems, you know? I mean, I'm in that boat right now. And it's one of those things where you can do your homework and you can do the pre-purchase and you can know the horse's joints inside and out. But, you know, you bring them from a different area, you find out they're allergic to your area. You know, there's just so many things that go into finding the right partner, and you can try to make it be the dream horse, but sometimes it's not going to be the dream horse, no matter how hard you try, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't want to go, I'm not saying to go again. I think people can make the mistake of not spending enough for the right kind of foundation and training. I think that's a really common thing too, that is weirdly attached to the dream horse idea as well. But you just have to take with a grain of salt when you go out, if you're using that term in your mind, that you could find the perfect horse and, you know, you could have all of the budget in the world and that horse can still colic, you know, the next day after you buy it. I mean, and that's not to be like scare people. It's more to be like, hey, just be sure that you are a little bit balanced in your approach. And you can, I mean, I have seen some freaky things in this line of work. We had a horse who got idiopathic peritonitis. He came within 15 minutes of being euthanized, and then they realized that it looked like he was going to, he at least was showing signs of life. You couldn't have predicted that. Like, I would have never seen that coming. It was no fault of where he was being kept. It was good care, all the things. And so these things that kind of come out of the blue, the dream horse label won't protect you from that. So just be sure you're choosing wisely for a little bit balanced things so that you don't kind of get in a situation where you're taken by surprise, you know, or you're not prepared. Gosh, if a horse could guarantee that it would never colic, I would pay a lot of money for that horse. That would be a dream horse, or it would never hurt itself. I mean, sure, $2 million, that's great, because it would probably actually end up saving you money ultimately with some of these guys. Jeez.
I know we're probably getting close to the end. But I did want to mention one other thing, and maybe this is something for a future episode, but Brooke and I were talking about like the misconceptions about like being in the horse industry and training and working, and like how we're just never allowed a day off sort of thing. And, you know, like we don't take time for ourselves, and just how that thinking kind of is in our industry, and how it can be really detrimental to people and their mental health in this business, and hanging in there and being the best for their horses and their students and all that. So that's something we were kind of talking about as well.
That's definitely a topic for another podcast. Yeah, go Brooke, because it's so endemic.
Yeah, well, it is. And like right now you're hearing about all these like suicides, right, in the horse industry, professionals and stuff like that. And it went bye-bye.
Yeah,
it went it's right just, out of my head.
It's just sad. It's sad though, because it's happening also in the, you know, in the vet industry.
Right.
And, you know, our vets they're so overworked and exhausted, and they take on so much. They love the horses, but then they're having to deal with, you know, the death and that side of it, and helping people through. I mean, it's a tough business, you know, and even for us that work with people and their horses, you know, you become so close to them, helping them through all these you know, setbacks they might have with their horses being injured or they're injured. And, you know, like when things are smooth sailing, I always just sit back and just be like, oh, just enjoy this moment, you know, because there's just a lot of ups and downs in the business, you know, dealing with hurt horses and dealing with, you know, just there's so much that you end up taking on.
Yeah. Well,
an empathetic person.
It can be stressful. Yeah, well, it's stressful and it could be exhausting. And that's what I mean. I think all these people are like, but you're not supposed to feel those ways. You're not supposed to feel stressed out or exhausted. You're supposed to just, I don't know, work 14 hours a day, 3 days a week, you know? And if you don't, then you must not want it that bad is how I feel, like how I've perceived it, you know? And even to this day, like, when I have a day off, there's still a piece of me that feels like guilty that I'm not at the barn. You know what I mean? And it's just like, oh man, it's tough, you know?
It is. Well, it's so time consuming to take care of them. And you know, I'm guilty of it too, where I'll think, well, I don't want to ask somebody else for help because that's going to take out of their day, you know, to help me out, so I'll just do it myself sort of thing. And then pretty soon you realize like, oh my gosh, I'm doing so much, I don't have any time for myself anymore even, you know. So yeah, that would be a good one we could carry on with for sure.
Yeah, well, I remember a couple years ago, Alicia, I think I interviewed you and we talked about self-care, on that interview, I think you were stepping back for a couple months. You were changing your lesson schedule and focusing on some young horses. And this was, I think, like 2 years ago, maybe three.
Yeah.
And that carried a lot of weight with my listeners, this idea of self-care is important. Like, if we don't take care of ourselves, then how can we take care of the horses? And it is true. It's hard to find people to take, like you said, I'll feel bad asking someone to help or whatever. And I'm fortunate in that, you know, I don't maintain a huge barn. We used to keep a lot more horses, and I realized that it actually worked better for our program to have fewer that we really focus on, and that, you know, kind of act almost as teachers. Like, that's really cool. But it's still like idiopathic peritonitis, you know, like that really scarred me for life, you know? And so I go around like, it's like, I've had too much information, you know, at times. Right. And it can be hard to, it can be hard to power down, to go, okay, I can stand down now. I really have to go out of town. And it's not because anybody forces me or I'm a victim of my job. It's more that it comes with the territory where you really, you care about these animals and you get to know them, and you know that it's not as easy for someone else to, it's not like feeding your cat, you know, once a day while you're out of town. And so I have to, most of the time, literally be off property out of state before I can go, okay, I really don't have to feed any animals today. Or I don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's definitely do a podcast episode on that. We are a little past the hour, so I want to let both of you go, because I know I was shocked, Brooke, at your schedule that you rode 8 horses, saddled 2 yearlings, and you're like apologizing for not having time to do the podcast. It's just, like, it's been, well, it's what been, a slacker.
Yeah. I know. These next 2 months are going to be long, but everybody's doing good. So it's been really, it's been fun. It's been fun. Right. But yes, long days. Lots of horses.
But I'm very proud of you, because you just, you told me the other day that you have dedicated Sundays as your partial day off, or, yay, you know.
So yeah, that's partial, not a full
I do
day.
Make myself take one day off. Yeah, because I realized, like, well, when I was living in Nashville, like with you and stuff, you know, when you have your friends around to be like, hey, dude, I think you're getting burnt out. Like, you know, go home for a couple of days or go do something, like go away, you know? And you don't realize like how burnt out you are until you take a break, you know?
Yeah.
But when you're kind of by yourself all the time riding and work, you know, like you aren't annoying anybody at your work, you know, cause you don't work with anybody. So you don't have anybody to tell you that you need to take a break. So I was like, well, I'll just do it for myself and just take Sundays off no matter what, you know.
That's really cool.
Then hopefully I won't get to that point anymore.
Well, I'll make a note never
need
to text
me to call you.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And remind you.
No, okay. It's not
but
that
make
bad.
Make sure you call me and tell me like that I need to take a day too. Because I'm not very good.
Yeah,
at
I do tell you. I tell you all the time. You should start sleep in on Sundays. Do you know?
You both should take Sundays off, and then you can be accountability partners. Like, you're not working, right? So you could do that to each other on Sundays. That would be good.
Right.
I'm taking 3 hours tomorrow.
Yeah.
Wow. Crazy. Nice.
Yeah.
Are you actually doing errands, or are you truly resting and taking the day off?
I'm doing errands. But yeah. I have a move coming up, so you know how that goes. It's like there's a million things to get sorted out, but so any of my time off now is like trying to organize my life, but it's like, you know, there's like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and I can see the pot of gold, and that's that I will be in the vicinity of where the horses are, so
cool.
Many things are going to change for the better. So, you know, the like 3 years ago when I took that sabbatical and was trying to figure out how to simplify my life and all that. And so now this is like coming to fruition finally after all these years of trying to make it happen. So it'll be good. It'll be worth it.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yay. Yay. So exciting.
Thank you guys both for the extra time. And I really enjoyed the conversation, took notes as always. And, you know, I'll think of you guys on Sunday and hope that you're both taking time off on Sunday. So
I'll be working, but thank you.
Yeah, you actually, you'll be working with me. Yes, right. We'll try to make it.
I'll be working.
Yeah. Damn. Okay, never mind. Forget that. Next Sunday, not this coming Sunday, a week from then, we will all be taking a Sunday off. How about that?
That would be good. Thank you so much for having us.
Take care, you guys. Bye.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye. All right.
In honor of this particular conversation and in honor of Alicia and Brooke, I'm very proud to announce that I actually personally took last Sunday off, which was the first Sunday in a while that I hadn't worked. So I want to thank them both for inspiring me to actually follow through and take my usual day off, even though I don't typically do that. I hope all of you got as much from this conversation as I did. If you'd like to follow Alicia and Brooke, they both have Facebook pages, Alicia Landman Horsemanship and Brooke Tatro Horsemanship. Brooke's website also is brooketatro.com. As always, thank you for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day.